Well, quite appropriately, that was released just before the September the 11th attacks in 2001. That was Orbital, the Doctor Who theme. Welcome back to BCFM's online politics show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Momentous U-turn as Huawei are booted out of the UK by 7 years' time in 2027. We ask a former GCHQ officer in a minute, since they trusted Huawei's equipment themselves, if there's any real security risk, or is this just what we have to do now in Britain? We are part of the US empire, guys. And after Freemason Kemal Atatürk made the Hagia Sophia Cathedral in Istanbul a museum, was one of the seven wonders of the world, Erdogan now turns it into a mosque. What's the reaction of Orthodox Christians? And what's the reason why the Russian Orthodox Church has such strong ties to this particular building? And Professor of Slavic Culture, Vladimir Goldstein, explains what Erdogan is up to. And following up from last week's bombshell about the Phoenicians from Lebanon, maybe beating Cabot and Columbus to the New World by 3,000 years, this week, Lindsay McCauley sailed on last December's epic voyage in a replica Phoenician galley, explains the Mayan pyramids link up to the Egyptian pyramids, and we were just hearing there from Hiram Abiff and Solomon's Temple, which the Phoenicians built around about 1000 BC, the temple that is in Jerusalem. It's the giveaway measurement of the cubit. How did they manage to fly across the Atlantic all the way to the Mayan temples? Was it a little mouth of a little bird? Who knows? Plus, the murder of WPC Yvonne Fletcher by MI6 and the CIA, explained in a Dispatches documentary, and then the whole industry of investigative journalism in London was shut down. A member of the SAS shares more evidence that it was the US, not the Libyans, that killed her in cold blood. But let's start, Martin, with the latest developments in places around the world like Syria and Yemen. Any thoughts about this week's development? Because I noticed just today, looking at the Israel apparently is hoping to start a war with Iran before the United States elections.
Yeah, well, there's been, as of last week as well, there have been various attacks inside Iran, which everybody's being very cagey about. But it looks as if the Israelis are looking basically to provoke a war, because they need to have a war soon, because they think Trump is more likely to back them than Biden. So that's very dangerous. Lebanon is in free fall, as we discussed last week. That's very dangerous. That could turn into a fight between the Israelis.
Because what the Israelis are basically, their analysis is that the potential of a war in the Middle East is going to be an election issue. And it may be that both of the candidates have to distance themselves from it, and that makes it less likely. So, this is effectively what the Israelis are saying.
Well, the Israelis, I mean, obviously in Trump, they've got somebody that's very much in their camp. Biden is pretty much in their camp. So they've got plenty, you know, they're looking for a showdown with Iran. And of course, Britain will have to do, we are a Rottweiler for the US. We will be expected to join in and support the
effort. How on earth are the Israelis going to persuade Britain and America to get involved in their war?
Well, they've been pretty successful thus far. We invaded Iraq, as we were talking about in the first hour. Did we need to do that? Not really. That was what they wanted, and that's what we did, with all the consequences.
Anyway, right next door to all of this, of course, is Syria, and that came up at Prime Minister's questions this week. I think it's quite interesting to see how that. Maybe before we hear from that, Martin, what do you make of what's happened there? Because most of it seems to have been forgotten about. Syria kind of never happened, and Assad is still in control, but he's some sort of bad guy. But that's the end of the story.
Well, it isn't. Obviously, what's happened is that the news media have moved on. Instead of cheerleading for an invasion of Syria or military action against Assad, it related to that story is, of course, Shamima Begum has won a court case to allow her to come back to Britain to try and regain her British citizenship. And of course, the tabloid press have been going bonkers about that. But of course, the real story there, as you and I know, Tony, is that she was recruited and groomed to go and fight for ISIS by a Canadian intelligence agent. Because in actual fact, what we were doing, Britain, Canada, the West, is encouraging people to go out there and fight.
He had a personality on Facebook. He groomed her on Facebook. He then met her and went across to Turkey, met her in Istanbul, and then apparently went down on a coach all the way down to southern Turkey and then handed her on to a British agent. The idea is, I mean, you think, well, why would they do this? Well, apparently this Canadian guy had only got his Canadian citizenship because he'd agreed to work for the Canadian intelligence. He was a Middle Eastern chap, and the intelligence services are going around basically offering out passports, British passports, Canadian passports, like confetti, for anyone who will play their games of trying to entrap people into ISIS.
Yeah, and I think that's the main point that the alternative media should be making about that particular case, is that she was groomed by Western intelligence, because Western intelligence set up ISIS along with Saudi Arabia, and we've subjected Syria to 9 years of misery, and that's our fault. We did that. That's what we're responsible for.
I mean, you say our fault. It happened under Labour, didn't it?
When I say our fault, I mean the government of Britain is responsible for that. How much control we've got over that is debatable, but they definitely were doing that. And then we have all this stuff about how ISIS is a terrible threat and all the rest of it. But we armed and trained them.
Trying to dodge the issue here about David Miliband, because it was under him that the Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, says that he was brought over to Britain. Miliband was in charge in those days, and I think he thought he was being quite clever, having secret meetings to try and start a civil war in Syria.
Yeah, and you'll notice that he wasn't elected as Labour leader. His brother was selected instead. We know that there's plenty of rot in the Labour Party. There's plenty of rot in the Tory Party. The establishment in this country are terrorists to the core. They've been supporting Islamist terrorism. As we speak now, the Saudi military are at Sandhurst being trained. They're being trained by the RAF. We're supplying them with weaponry. Hundreds of British military personnel are operating in Saudi Arabia as we speak, that great democracy, helping them to destroy Yemen. And, okay, of course, that's been going on and still goes on.
Well, I think we should go on and talk about that after we've heard about Syria. So let's go to Prime Minister's questions on Wednesday to hear that point made.
Marco Long. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Last week, China and Russia vetoed the United Nations Security Council approving aid to Syria from Turkey. How will the United Kingdom, Mr. Speaker, continue to help those in need in Syria?
Minister.
The United Kingdom is disappointed about the reduction in aid corridors in Syria. We are pleased that the cross-border humanitarian access will continue through Bab al-Hawa, but we are appalled that Russia exercised its veto and restricted aid through Bab al-Salam. The UK remains committed to supporting Syrians who are the victims of the egregious politicisation of humanitarian, and we recently announced $300 million to the Syrian Pledging Conference.
Well, that wasn't Boris, wasn't Prime Minister's questions. I'm not quite sure who that was, a Foreign Office Minister, I imagine. But Martin, he's got a bit of a cheek, hasn't he, saying, oh, we're giving aid. We're not helping the terrorists. We're not helping the Free Syrian Army. We're not helping ISIS. Oh, we're just trying to help the Syrian people through Turkey.
Yeah, and of course, there's still sanctions on Syria. So we're not letting any aid or any help go in through the mainstream channels in Syria. The only aid that we're prepared to allow to go in has to go in through terrorist or freedom fighter controlled areas. Take your pick. And of course, we have armed, trained and directed those so-called freedom fighters, many of them from all over the world, from Uyghurs, from China, lots of Libyans. There's obviously quite a big exchange going on between parts of Libya and Syria. The Turks are facilitating that. And this is all part of NATO policy. And all the crocodile tears about how terrible it is that the terrible regime in Syria has done all these terrible things. We are responsible for wrecking that country. We are directly responsible here in this country. And when are we going to compensate them? Who's going to pay for it all?
There's been some very big changes in the role of the RAF around the world since World War II. So I thought it'd be interesting to hear this Prime Minister's question about the Royal Air Force and the last surviving member, I think it's of a fighter command or bomber command, who's being honoured at the moment.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. On Friday, the last surviving Battle of Britain aircrew member, Group Captain John Hemingway, turns 101 in the week that marks the 80th anniversary of the start of that pivotal campaign. In contrast with that golden generation, he will not seek any recognition for himself. But we ought to shine a spotlight on the sacrifice of those who defended freedom, and particularly the 1,500 from all commands who fell. Would the Prime Minister give some thought to how we might recognise Group Captain John Hemingway, not for himself, but as the final representative of the few?
I'm Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I thank him for his question. I will indeed think about what we can do. As he knows, these are matters for the Honours Committees, which are independent of government, and I would urge him strongly to make his representations to them.
Well, John Hemingway, Martin, I wonder what he would make of what's going on right now in Saudi Arabia with the bombing of innocent. I mean, the latest is 25 civilians today killed, Yemeni children dying in Saudi attacks. We're using British aircraft and British munitions.
Well, you'd have to ask him, wouldn't you? I don't know what his politics were. You can't guess. But there is a very poignant contrast, isn't there, between the Battle of Britain, where the RAF's defending Britain against attack, and going to Saudi Arabia, that democratic country, as I mentioned earlier, and pulverising the Yemenis, who are the poorest people in the Middle East, and they're now suffering from the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. And not only are we not helping, we are causing it. And yet we all want to come home and have a nice cup of tea.
Yeah, I mean, it's also worth mentioning that the reason that the Blitz happened in the first place, apparently Hitler was, during the early parts of the war, up till sort of 40, 41, 42, was angling to make, well, certainly up until 41, was angling to make deals with the Brits, and he was reluctant to do bombing because he thought, well, if we do start bombing, we're going to be less likely to do deals with the British. But as Karina Urbach said in her book, this is a German journalist, and it was reported in the Daily Mail. I'll put a link up to it on our show page at this week. .org.uk. It was none other than King Edward VIII, the former King Edward VIII, who met with the German diplomats in Lisbon and persuaded them to start bombing. He was basically saying, well, look, unless you actually start bombing London in the Blitz, then the Brits won't listen to you and they won't negotiate. But if you start to bomb London, then the negotiations can start. So amazing that it was actually a British king, albeit, of course, a German family, the Saxe-Coburg-Gothas, that actually started the Blitz, Martin. Amazing stuff. And, you know, if people don't believe that, then I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to this article. The headline is, Edward VIII was a Nazi sympathiser who wanted Britain to be bombed into submission by Hitler, claims this historian.
Well, I'm not at all surprised. And, of course, you could argue that by switching the attack from the RAF's bases to basically civilian targets in towns, they lost the Battle of Britain. So it may well be that that decision was the wrong decision from the German point of view. But anyway, as we know, by the end of the war, we'd incinerated Dresden, and the Americans had incinerated loads of people in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And, well, you know, what was acceptable and unacceptable had completely changed.
According to Karina Urbach, Edward VIII blamed the Jews for World War II, and he wanted Germany to emerge victorious from the conflict. He said, effective bombing of England will bring peace to Europe.
Yes, well, it's well known that the Queen Mum, you know, the present Queen's mother, was of that kind of ilk as well. And, of course, what subsequently happened, it was all hushed up. Prescott Bush in the United States was very pro-Hitler. And in actual fact, in that era, lots of people in that kind of social group were. And nobody should be surprised about that.
We were here
since the war as well.
We were hearing just the other week about appeasement and the Russians, Putin particularly, saying that that was a terrible thing to do. So it's a bit difficult, isn't it? I mean, should there... I mean, we could be in this situation again where we get to the point where war becomes inevitable, and to actually shy away from it means that your people are just going to be subsumed by some evil enemy. Do you think we're reaching that point? Have we reached that point?
Each war is uniquely horrible in its own way, and therefore it's you can't just extrapolate from what might or might not have been a good policy 50 years ago and pursue the same policy. You know, the history is full of contradictory lessons. The First World War was started because people basically just allowed themselves to be led by the nose into something they didn't really understand. I think the situation now isn't like the First World War, and it isn't like the Second World War. It's the Third World War, which is going to be uniquely horrible in its own way.
Well, it'd be interesting to see when that actually, if and when it happens, because a lot of this, Martin, could simply be saber-rattling and making, basically like this thing we're about to talk about with Huawei, it's about trying to make sure that you keep your market more than actually having a fighting war.
Yeah, but I mean, it depends where you live, doesn't it? I mean, the Second World War began long before 1939 in places like Abyssinia or Manchuria or Spain. And in actual fact, that those kind of battles are raging now. If you live in Syria, you've been through 9 years of hell. And as I said earlier, Britain, one of the major culprits. In Yemen, years and years of misery. Britain, one of the major culprits. And, you know, just because there hasn't been a bomb on your street recently doesn't mean that the war hasn't started.
OK, so well, let's have a listen now to former GCHQ officer Alex Thompson now, because I asked him earlier this week about this decision for Britain to ban Huawei. And I was wondering particularly whether this is just simply a trade decision because of the trade deal that's going on right now between Britain and the United States, that Britain has got to kind of do what it's told. Otherwise, it's not going to get a trade deal with Trump.
I'm Alex Thompson. I report every week for UK Column News on Wednesdays under the brand name of Eastern Approaches. I've lived in the Netherlands now for over a decade as a freelance translator and interpreter most of that time. Before that, I was a GCHQ officer from 2001 to 2009. And shortly after leaving GCHQ to emigrate, I started asking myself more serious questions about the leadership. I must stress the leadership, not the rank and file of the security and intelligence agencies and what their worldview was.
You say an officer. Is this almost like a kind of military position? Because most people would associate the word officer with, say, for example, the police or the military.
It is remarkable, Tony. The American intelligence and security agencies all use the term agent, which people are probably familiar with from Hollywood and police series and so on. In Britain, we reserve that term for people who, on a paid basis, inform an intelligence or security agency or a police force. And those who are on the books as staff are known in the British intelligence and security agencies as officers, even though they are not in receipt of a Queen's Commission. It's a civilian job, as in fact, at law, is being a policeman. Of course, the police call their employees, their sworn employees anyway, officers, but they are not. I know it's a courtesy title for constables in the United States, but it's completely wrong and unlawful to call policemen, let alone intelligence agents, officers in the British context. It's just a habit that's developed internally.
Well, obviously, there's quite a lot secret, but can you tell us what can you tell us of what you did do when you were at GCHQ? Because this is a place which has been for many years shrouded in mystery, particularly since the trade unions were removed back in the 1980s under Margaret Thatcher. There was a whole campaign for Thatcher to remove the civil service trade unions from GCHQ in Cheltenham. And give us an idea of the sort of role that GCHQ has and, you know, what you can tell us about what you were doing there.
GCHQ started off as what many people will recognise if I say Bletchley Park, a location near Milton Keynes, although Milton Keynes didn't exist then, it's a new city, in Buckinghamshire. So it's equidistant between Oxford and Cambridge, that location in Bletchley. And during the Second World War, as people will know if they follow encryption stories or thrillers, they will know that the Enigma and other Third Reich and Japanese codes were broken there at Bletchley Park. The formal name of the organization back in those days was GC&CS, the Government Crypt and Cipher School. And these were really pioneer days. There were some absolutely brilliant mathematicians and linguists and computer scientists pioneering the personal computer, well, the precursor of the personal computer, in order to crack very hard cipher during the war. And that tradition has continued. The British continue to be regarded by their partners in the other English-speaking nations that are part of their Five Eyes Club, the Americans, the Australians, the New Zealanders and the Canadians. The British continue to be regarded as punching above their weight for their skill in these areas, obscure areas. GCHQ is a name that was taken on just after the Second World War. The site moved first to a location in West London and then out to Cheltenham in Gloucestershire, where it's been ever since. And through the Cold War, GCHQ's existence was in some ways even more secret than that of MI5 and MI6. And as you mentioned, Tony, there was a time in the early 80s, 1984, when a staff dispute over the ability, the right, as the staff saw it, to join a union led to mass sackings of quite a few GCHQ employees under Mrs. Thatcher. That was reversed under Tony Blair's government, one of his first decisions in 1997 after coming into office. So GCHQ is there to do signals intelligence and information security. Signals intelligence is tracking communications either between people, which is communications intelligence, or communications coming from electronic sources, for example, transponders on vehicles on land, sea and air. That side of the house is called electronic intelligence. Together that makes signals intelligence. There is also, if you like, that's the poacher's role. There's also the gamekeeper's role, which is preventing other nations from doing that to our government and leading corporations. And that is called information security and is managed by a part of GCHQ, which in recent years, under a new branding, the National Cyber Security Centre, has got itself its own office in Westminster, having been in the Cheltenham building for many years. My own role was in translating, transcribing and reporting on political material.
So there is another side to all of this, isn't there? And that is that the surveillance role that GCHQ has can possibly be exchanged with private business, especially when there is a certain amount of encouragement for them to be doing this with from governments. I mean, I've seen certainly the other intelligence services, MI6 and MI5, have been over the years encouraged to share intelligence with big business, effectively to enable those big companies to maybe leverage a bit better around the world if they've got the right information to do so. But this, of course, means that some of the tools that GCHQ can use to access our private personal information could potentially be used for things like data mining, that is to say, getting vast databases to profile literally millions of individuals in Britain and around the world. So what guarantees do we have as members of the public, and particularly MPs, lawyers and journalists, that the ability to use surveillance for legitimate national security reasons is not being abused?
We have very few such guarantees. And the same is true in the other members of the Five Eyes Partnership, the other English-speaking countries, and if anyone's listening from the continent of Europe, although that's a civil law tradition, the amount of parliamentary oversight and government supervision is actually just as thin there. The word that you'll hear often in intelligence circles is legality, which strangely is often pluralized to legalities as well, which increasingly I've come to see as not a nod to the law, but a denial of the law, particularly the first principles of law. The idea is that the intelligence and security agencies have had their functions increasingly regulated by statute in a process beginning in the 1980s, certainly getting underway in the 1990s. And then there's been various rounds of European and world level enactments of international law into British statute law, which are supposed to stop the infringement of people's private data and communications for anything but lawful purposes by government itself. But of course, there are exceptions. And if you enact something in a statute, it needs then to be put into practice in a framework document. In the United States model, you would have an act passed by Congress telling NSA, which is the American security equivalent, the American Communications and Intelligence Agency, not to spy beyond certain boundaries. That then has to be implemented by the White House into an executive order. And then, you know, you get the policy decisions. What you mentioned there about companies possibly getting the gist of people's data and communications via the security and intelligence agencies is actually possible. I became dimly aware in my time at GCHQ that certain MI5 officers, for example, spoke in terms of there being what they called an A-list, seemed to be a semi-official term they used, which was a list of companies that were felt to be important enough to Britain, or to UK PLC, as they sometimes said, that they would be in receipt of some kind of slightly sanitized, slightly watered down intelligence. GCHQ's intelligence, at least officially, was not and probably is not shared with companies in that way. But there are ways of disguising the source. The other way that a company can get involved, of course, is through partnerships and becoming a contractor to a security and intelligence agency. NSA in the States, again, has got far more contractors working for it in its headquarters and other locations than government staff. I say far more, certainly more in absolute terms. And these include some very big contractors that in the age of Snowden and WikiLeaks have become well known for that role, such as the MITRE Corporation and Booz Allen Hamilton. And these companies build and hold the data for NSA. And of course, GCHQ fishes from the same data pools. There's also a very under-discussed Israeli angle to all this, which we see popping up in areas such as recently when the National Health Service for Britain, and particularly its data and technical arm, NHSX, started partnering with GCHQ. And who's in the background of that? Matthew Gould, former British ambassador in Tel Aviv. And then we get some very strange links going through to Unit 8200, the Israeli Signals Intelligence Agency, which actually is also active. It does things that would be unlawful and illegal in Britain and America, which is actually fiddled with data while it's not in transit, which would be breaking the terms of the statutory bounds of only looking at communications. So more hacking and shaping views among the public, something the Third Reich also did with its intelligence agency, particularly the Signals Intelligence Bureau did that.
So, I mean, you seem to be hinting here that particularly with the official, I mean, we're talking about the government agencies from Israel, it may be actually more of a Six Eyes than a Five Eyes here.
I've long suspected it, Tony. I don't want to make any assertions I can't back up. There was a time a couple of years ago when, with my colleague David Ellis, who concentrates heavily on European military unification and what's going on there, reporting on that, we did a talk in Devon, which we called the Emergency Briefing, which people can find on the ukcolumn.org site if they go to the European Military Unification landing page of that website. And in my talk, I was starting to hint at that, and I had intended to go on to a second half, teasing it out. But there are hints. If you read the well-known whistleblowers' books, the ones that really got into trouble, like Spycatcher, the well-known book that caused a hoo-ha in the 1980s over its publication, of course, the author of Spycatcher was vehemently denying this. There was a Soviet defector saying the Israelis are the silent partner piggybacking on all this, and you Brits and Americans are spending the money, especially the Americans, and the British providing a lot of brain power together with the Americans, and all of this stuff is just being hoovered up by Israel. And, of course, the officers of the time, including the author of that book, did not want to believe it, because names were named. Members of the Rothschild family, for example, who were very good friends to MI5, as the author of that book put it. It has been suggested, but now we're in the post-Maxwell age. The second generation of Maxwell is now becoming a household name for links, allegedly, to Mossad and Unit 8200. It all does seem to be hinting in that direction, but I wouldn't like to pin it just on the project of the political arm of Zionism, the political version of Zionism. It's more to do with corporations than it is to do with the nation state of Israel, I think, the ultimate beneficiary of this massive spy system.
Well, I mean, the other what you've reminded me of here is the very, very important and often forgotten Amdocs scandal in the United States, which was exposed by Carl Cameron on Fox News back in 2001, where he showed that the Israeli, basically Israeli mafia, were over operating in the United States, and that they were able to use their links to the telecoms companies of the United States in order to observe when taps were put on their phones, so that as soon as a tap was put onto one of the Israeli mafia's phones in the United States by the FBI or another agency in the US, then all of a sudden there would be warnings of those people would then stop their operations, swap their phones, move their bases, locations, and many of them would then return to Israel, and new people would go to take over from them. So this is seems quite clear to me, certainly from that report and what you've just said, that there is a great deal of vulnerability to the West's telecoms infrastructure to the Israelis. But look, what we're really here to talk about now is about this enormous, I think, quite a momentous decision, in fact, a U-turn by the British government to say, no, we don't want any Huawei kit in our telecoms system. In fact, it's all got to go. We've got to take the stuff that's there out. Can you just first explain to us, is this, do you think, something that is motivated by national security? Is there really a particular national security risk from using Huawei equipment in our mobile networks?
If there is, and I'm not discounting that there is such a risk, then it's very odd that, as I've mentioned to you before, I think 13 years ago, GCHQ, particularly its information security branch, decided there was no objection to having Huawei UK, which of course is a daughter company of the Huawei in the People's Republic of China that's majority owned by the army, or was at that stage, they decided there was no objection to having Huawei UK being a partner in the consortium to supply the new classified internal telephony service between GCHQ and other parts of the British security apparatus, and with the Americans and other Five Eyes partners as well. And that was duly done, to the great chagrin of some GCHQ officers at the time, who said this is a serious state risk, and they were told to shut up about it. Now, the time that that happened was the ascendancy of, he's been knighted these days, Sir Mark Sedwill, who was a champion of the intelligence agencies at Home Office and Foreign Office level, who eventually became the supremo. He took a new role, created only in 2010 in one of David Cameron's first acts in office. He created this new apparatus, a National Security Council and a National Security Advisor, to be a kind of gatekeeper of what intelligence picture reaches the politicians. And Sedwill has just stepped down as, I think, the third in the series of those new officers. And as his people get cleared out, evidently they've got some enemies now, Dominic Cummings and Sir David Frost being two that I think the Sedwill crowd have got the knives out for. As these people fall, so the decision is reversed. So either there was a security risk then and there still is now, because it's a kind of a fortiori argument. You know, if it's a risk for the general public, then so much the more for the intelligence services to be speaking at top secret level on that equipment or that using that software, I should say. Or there was not. But either way, the timing of the decisions indicates that politics and worldview of a certain clique of securocrats is what's dominant here over really cold technical considerations of security risks. What I've come to increasingly realise, I think, is that in this world of information security, which is a political asset that Britain touts in NATO and on the European continent and even with the Americans, what you've got there is the power of a monopoly of narrative. You can say, trust us, this isn't safe. If you do this, the Russians will hack you or whatever. You're framing the narrative that way. You're effectively cutting certain partners out of the market. And by your recommendations or lack of objections, you're fostering other corporations. It's an inherently political, economic, financial decision to make such recommendations.
C- Can you just explain a bit more about Cedwill and the kind of faction that's going out with Cedwill, and why is it that there's a change? Is this connected with the Boris government? And in which case, it may obviously be connected with Brexit too. So I wonder if we're looking at a more pro-British nationalist or patriotic bunch coming in rather than a pro-EU, pro-Brussels civil servants.
That is a good way of shorthanding it. I would perhaps say, instead of British nationalist, that the paradigm that the incomers are advocating is Anglo-Saxon cooperation, so English-speaking countries, Commonwealth. It's one of the things we've been heard, the drums that we've heard being banged for a while now. Global Britain is Britain's future after leaving the European Union. That's been a general slogan. Now we're getting a sort of tightening up of it, that Britain will have harder borders. You see it with customs and borders now, although there are obviously laughable leaks in it. The general course of government, and certainly since Cummings has come to the fore, seems to be to take a harder analytical look, less fluffy language that the Mark Sedwill crowd used about basically sort of Fabian socialism ideas of brotherhood of man and certainly political and economic unification of the European continent, including Britain. That was that clique's agenda, for sure. The Cummings agenda, with Frost replacing Sedwill as National Security Advisor, does seem to be much more working in lockstep with the United States. And by that, I don't mean the Trump government necessarily, or the people around him like Steve Bannon, or who have been around him in the past like Steve Bannon, who are thinkers. I'm talking in terms of the established Pentagon and NSA, CIA establishment, who see the world as, you know, the Five Eyes versus the nefarious Eurasian powers. That seems to be coming to the fore again, yes.
Because this Huawei decision is exactly what the United States wanted. They've been lobbying for it, in fact, in quite a bullying fashion for a long time. And of course, they are, one might say, even obsessed with Huawei, having 18 months ago arrested the chief financial officer of Huawei in Canada, and they're now trying to extradite her to the United States. And a lot of people have pointed the finger at this Meng Wanzhou's arrest in Canada as what has precipitated the Chinese now saying, well, okay, so if you're going to extradite Meng Wanzhou from our Huawei person from Canada to the United States, we're going to now start looking at extraditing individuals from Hong Kong into mainland China. And of course, this has kicked off a whole row over there too. So, I mean, aren't we simply just poodles to the Americans, just doing exactly what the Americans want without any real consideration from the advice we've been getting from the security services in Britain?
I wouldn't discount that side of it, but I think that, yes, people who are a particular kind of conscientious observer of the scene, possibly of a left of center tradition, and to take a moral view of politics, have long warned Tony Benn, for example, a great among such a tradition, long warned about this. He was a great lover of the Americans himself, of course, but always talked about a particular clique running the American deep state as having Britain really in its grasp and not to the benefit of either nation. There is something of that in it. But if you look further back in history, there has been a much longer and quite determined and extremely secretive tradition coming out of Oxford University and Whitehall from the 1870s, and certainly by the time of the First World War, it had got the upper hand, of steering the Americans and what were then called the Dominions, the English-speaking Commonwealth countries, we'd say now, in a certain direction so that we remained a unified geopolitical force. And the names of some of the bodies that Britain is alleged, or the British deep state is alleged to use in this in America, have become household names among viewers and listeners of the American alternative media scene in the last decade, as a lot more comes out on the internet. Companies like Serco, which began as the Radio Company of America in the 1920s, and bodies in the United States like the Senior Executive Service. There are false or exaggerated claims about what these bodies do. They are not all taking orders from the descendants of Sir Cecil Rhodes, but there is an intellectual element of that in it. And British soft power, as represented, I think, by Sedwell and his ilk, still has this view, even though they're concentrating on unifying Europe, that they have a view that the American muscle is needed, and also the financial clout, because it takes trillions to play in the game of electronic espionage.
What about the move towards confrontation with China, though? Surely this Huawei business is just simply, it's kind of a financial warfare, economic warfare shot across the bows.
When we get to the intentions of the leadership of China as a country, then, you know, that's a very obscure area in which many claims and counterclaims are made. I would think there would be a genuine spectrum of opinion among those who think carefully about China, whether they do genuinely pose an expansionist militarist threat or not. Of course, it's possible to take non-simplistic positions here. It is possible to say, and this has happened in the lead up to both world wars and other major confrontations in the modern era, it is possible to say correctly that a certain state that's on the rise industrially and in terms of its morale is a threat to the Anglo-American world order, and yet still to misuse that claim in order to use China, and I think Russia in many ways, as a bogeyman. This happens particularly when we get this dialogue, this discourse of cultural influence and disinformation coming along. So the friends of China in the West, I'm genuinely ambivalent about China as a state towards the West. I think it has much promise and also many hazards to us, but that could be said of many other powerful countries in the world. The friends and advocates of China in the West are quite right, I think, to point out that Britain and America are very hypocritical indeed to take measures and to instigate third countries to take measures against cultural arms like the Confucius Institute at a time when it's very well known that Britain's direct equivalent, the British Council, has been repeatedly accused by Russia of just the same kind of subversion, soft power, turning of minds and light espionage being used through the British Council in countries around Eurasia. So there's a complicated game here. And it's, you know, the main question, of course, to an honest observer is, are we accusing these countries of things that we are doing ourselves or not?
Well, yes. And I wonder also is if it's simply that the US industrialists realize that they cannot compete with Huawei. They've got to find a way to keep Huawei out of European markets.
This reminds me of an interview which has enjoyed a new lease of life recently on YouTube with the late Sir Jimmy Goldsmith, in which just after GATT had become the World Trade Organization, or I think even before that, so in 1994-95 time frame, he warned in a long, formal sit-down American TV interview in a darkened room that there was going to be a complete loss, a bleeding out of the middle class in America and other industrialized nations, G7 nations, basically, by dint of outsourcing industrial and increasingly intellectual property production from the West to China and India. And it's incontrovertible, whichever way you look at it, that the elite, the economic elite, as well as the security elite of the Western countries, Anglo-American and the continental ones, did decide at this point, I think particularly the Brits and the Americans, to use East Asia and South Asia as their new powerhouse. Now, there may be many nefarious intents there, such as pilfering the intellectual property out of a country to make it less competitive. There are all kinds of valid arguments and analytical lines to take about why this was done. But what is not possible to argue in good faith is that this outsourcing to China was done without the connivance of the people in power at the time.
And there is a third force in a lot of this, and that's Henry Kissinger. He's got lines into the deep state, both in China and in the United States. One does wonder why we heard so little from him. He's basically warned, hasn't he, over the pandemic. Recently, he was saying, well, look, unless we get some sort of much more powerful global order, something that can do what the UN can't do out of this pandemic, then we could be heading for war. In fact, he warns of that directly. I wonder what you think people like Kissinger, who've got fingers in, or should we say feet in both camps, what's their role?
I think ultimately, if you take a cynical view, it is to ensure that any confrontation that develops benefits corporations. Corporations at that level, and some of these very rich bloodlines that span countries and have people in both warring camps, branches of the family in both camps, they think about the outcome of a war before it starts. Kissinger was interestingly warning there about, what Churchill would also call George War being better than War War, but he kind of inverts it to an idea that war is a threat which is enhanced if the right kind of international dialogue and harmonization isn't happening. Ultimately, what is Kissinger? I mean, people have accused him of being the leader of the Fourth Reich, all kinds of things. It is extremely remarkable that he has remained the doyen of American foreign policy for so many decades into extreme old age. And what is he? Does he represent the survival of a certain kind of German blue blood that wished to see a deal with corporatocratic elements in the West in order to finally, ultimately, to subvert Britain and America as rival economies? There's an element of that to it. There's an element of collusion here with a certain strand of Zionism, which, of course, gets people into very hot water for talking about, but it's been a reality from the 1930s onwards. But we shouldn't ultimately think about countries at that level. Men like Kissinger really see victories for certain systems and corporations, and they like to steer confrontations and possible wars in a direction that will produce a favourable outcome for certain corporations.
So when Henry Kissinger says there may be a war if we don't get the outcome of the pandemic right, is that a threat or a warning, a nice warning or something a little bit more like a threat?
It's, I would say, a veiled threat. You could say there's a softer version of it, perhaps nowhere near as evil, but a slight echo of that is found in this renowned statement by Jack Ma, you know, this fated Chinese entrepreneur of the current day, who says that when trade stops, war starts. Mm. Well, that could be just taken as, you know, homespun wisdom. But I think Mr. Ma, for example, I certainly don't describe bad motives to him, but he's foreseeing something else there. He's saying that the special interests in an economy, an advanced economy, the people who have direct lines to policymakers, just will not sit down and accept the loss of certain markets or the continued suboptimal performance of a workforce in a particular country. They will take measures such as flooding a particular economy with a certain kind of immigrant labour or causing the death of the wrong kind of worker and dependent. I think just Jack Ma is aware that this kind of thing goes on and that ultimately certain corporations or their leaders and owners do regard us as cattle. And do see us in terms of a triangle, you know, what a person in a population produces currency and energy and work, basically. And if those things are not optimized, there's a reshuffle. This is pretty much as near the bone you can get as to analysis of why world wars are engineered, sometimes by corporatist thinkers on both sides of a division before there's a war.
Just get back to Huawei finally. If I've got a router in my house, which is a Huawei router, do I need to be concerned?
There is no way of not being concerned in the internet age about your data. Any device that is wired to the internet, or not wired, but connected in any wireless way, is vulnerable. An often overlooked domain of the vulnerability, well, there's two. One is close access, which is something on your device itself tracking what you're typing and reading. And the other is a secret or backdoor deal with the providers of your software and hardware or your internet service provider or telecoms provider, whereby all your data will be hived off anyway, regardless of who's providing some of the software on the trunk that the communications are going down. It could be taken off a side route and given to your national government signals intelligence agency and then possibly put in a transnational sharing pool. So that there is no way to be entirely assured of your data. But as you were hinting earlier in the interview, it's certainly true. The West, especially the US and Britain, have taken a very lackadaisical approach to national communication infrastructure for decades, while claiming to be the world experts in securing it. We deliberately went away from copper networks, in which Britain probably had the world's best copper network in the 1980s, very hard to tap by comparison. And you could make a call from the Channel Islands to Shetland in perfect quality back then. You can't do that now at the same ease and cheapness, it seems, in real terms and with the same security. Countries in Eurasia, Russia, China, India, Israel, have taken a much more national security approach to the communication infrastructure. It's almost as if they want their countries to be secure, defensible entities, which I don't think you could say of the people running most of the Western countries.
So if we want privacy, we've got to use paper. Is that the only way?
It's one of the best ways. face-to-face meeting with no electronic devices around is certainly recommendable, but not living in paranoia, that's no solution. If people have a lot of information in the grey zone that's maybe embarrassing to them, but isn't certainly, you know, a big secret, and that they're a bit tentative about talking in case their personal data gets shared, there are strategies other than paranoia to dealing with that situation. For example, wrapping and padding all that you say with a lot of much less interesting blather. That will soon tire out the humans or the artificial intelligence that's trying to look for the needle in the haystack. The more volume you produce and the more inanity you produce, the less interested people it will be in what you're saying.
Well, maybe you should just put all your microphones on and turn the BBC on then, and that will really bore them to tears. Finally, Alex, you know, we're getting such a lot of nonsense from the mainstream press these days. I find myself very annoyed, literally, by the lies, the fake news that we're getting through a lot of mass media and the just complete failure to do any proper analysis or contextualise developments. Can you just give us a couple of hints as to where you think a good place is to go and get, you know, something which is a little bit more reliable to... and maybe thought-provoking when it comes to our daily news?
There are very many excellent sources of alternative news now, just in the English language, and they're coming on in leaps and bounds in other languages too. But for the English-speaking world, obviously I'd recommend our own outlet, ukcolumn.org, which also, for who knows how long, has a YouTube channel. But we are able to do more work if people actually become subscribers and watch through the website. They don't have to donate a great deal in order to do that. UKcolumn.org, there is American Free Press. There is 21st Century Wire, with whom we work very closely at UK Column. And there are one-person operations of extremely high quality, such as James Corbett of the Corbett Report, who is a Canadian reporting from Japan, very smart on a number of long-term investigations. And among websites, I would particularly recommend Consortium News and globalresearch.ca. There are many others. The Wall Will Fall, a very good one, concentrating on Middle Eastern reporting. But once you're into a couple of these, the friends you build up online will point you to others, whether or not you're on social media. And don't go by one or two sources, but go to any source that urges you to look at primary documents for yourself and embeds them in the article, instead of telling you what to think about them, like the BBC and the broadsheets do.
Just to wrap up, this decision about Huawei, am I right? You think that it's more to do with geopolitics than it is about national security?
At that level, geopolitics always trumps national security, because the people who control geopolitics, the clue being in the word geo, meaning world, are not interested in nations ultimately. They're interested in their own fraternity.
Alex Thompson, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
So, Martin, lots in there. I would just hazard American Free Press, I find a little bit far right. They have quite a lot of far right stuff in there. But, I mean, obviously, that's totally up for Alex to decide for himself. And they were the inheritors of The Spotlight, which were the only paper in the world reporting properly on the Bilderberg conferences. But anyway, what do you make of what you've just heard? I think, you know, we went all over the place, really, looking at the particularly the security, intelligence world, communications, and the real reasons behind the attempt to get rid of Huawei over the next 5-6 years. What did you make of what you've just heard?
Well, it's sort of covering a lot of ground there, so it'd be difficult to pick up on all of it.
Is there anything you'd like to pick out as, you know, interesting points or debate with Alex?
Well, I think it's always interesting to hear from somebody who's been on the inside of a structure like GCHQ. I think that Huawei basically is a political football. You know, when we were friendly with the Chinese and we're all going to be chummy and you know, the world's, you know, George Osborne was seeing China as a definite, you know, Chinese investment in Britain is quite substantial. So if you start, I mean, this is what the Chinese ambassador said when they made the decision to get rid of Huawei. He said, well, you can do that, but there are going to be consequences. So, you know, when you're looking for us to fund various things, maybe we're not going to pony up the money. You're looking to get various contracts in China. Well, maybe you're not going to get them. I mean, everything has its price.
Okay, yeah, the other key thing he's talking about there is this whole idea of the six eyes, Israel being the secret. I mean, it's funny the way they use one eye for each country. I thought most countries, if they're like people, have two eyes. But no, it's like the one eye at the top of the pyramid or in the forehead or whatever. You know, it's a little bit spooky imagery. But what about six eyes rather than five?
Well, I think the five eyes is a bit of a mythology anyway. I mean, it's very much part of the pre-internet era. When they, you know, the technology was very different from what it is now.
Hang on, Martin. Pre-internet, it was Yakuza. It was the UK-USA agreement, which the other countries were in on. Five Eyes is a formal intelligence sharing agreement. He was talking there about pooled information between the five nations.
Yes, and of course the Israelis are separate, but absolutely integrated in all of it. It's quite possible that they've got complete access to everything the Five Eyes have got access to, even though the Five Eyes don't even know they've got it. He's saying that it's basically corporations that run things. I think corporations do run things, but it's also filtered through perceptions of national interest. The idea that there's a kind of supranational ruling class that has no longer got any interest in the national state, I think that's just wrong. The two things are embedded in each other.
Well,
the success of a corporation often depends upon the support of a government.
Well, that's the way it certainly appears in the West, particularly in the United States and the EU, is that you've got big transnational companies, big banks, seem to actually be more powerful and working much more closely together. I mean, we're talking here actually about people like PricewaterhouseCoopers and KPMG too, more powerful than individual national governments, surely.
Yeah, the national governments in the West serve those private interests that you've identified, and one you haven't identified is the military-industrial complex.
Yeah.
What they don't like about China and Russia is that the balance there is a bit different. The Chinese government is not a liberal government, which is run entirely in the interests of Chinese corporations. The same is true of Putin and his faction, if you like, in Russia. They're known as the Siloviki. They came from the security infrastructure, not from the business side of things. And basically, big business in Russia was put in its place by Putin, which is one of the reasons why the people in the West hate it.
How and when was big business? I mean, I suppose you're talking here about the 1990s days of the oligarchs, the Yeltsin era.
Yeah.
How did Putin put these people in their place?
Well, he hasn't completely put them in their place because that would be a revolutionary thing to do. And what he's tried to do is drag back from. I mean, basically, Khodorkovsky, for example, who Putin put in prison, he was basically, like many oligarchs in Russia, he's of Jewish extraction, he's got Israeli citizenship. He was basically going to give the Israelis the Russian oil industry. And at that point, Putin put his foot down and said, no, you're not doing that. The Russian national interest trumps your private sector deal. And he scotched it. He made sure that the energy industry in Russia remains largely in the public sector. And therefore, all of the profits from it are at the disposal of the Russian government. But don't forget, if Yeltsin and his backers in the West had had his way, all of the oil in Russia would now belong to Western multinationals, and all the profit would be just being sloshed back into the city of London and Wall Street. He put a stop to that, which is what's caused a lot of the grief and a lot of the anger, because everybody in the West who at first thought that he was going to play ball. But he didn't. And the Chinese, of course, have opened their economy up. That's what they were asked to do. They've done it, but they haven't privatized everything. The commanding heights of the economy in China, including the banks, remain in the hands of the government. This is basically denying the Western way of doing things, which is why we can't get on with them, because they won't accept our way of doing things, in which the corporations are basically the bosses and the governments are the servants.
I mean, that surely is the ultimate capitalism. It's when the banks basically buy up anything that opposes them.
Well, capitalism as a theory is to do with free markets and consumer choice. But real capitalism has always been about the interaction between entrepreneurs and technology and governments. governments are absolutely important. Government spending is one of the most important sources of private profit in any country. And if you can get government contracts, that's a far easier way to make money than inventing a better widget.
As we sort of edge towards this further tension with China, one of the key areas, of course, is the Middle East. The Chinese have made it absolutely clear they want the Palestinians to have East Jerusalem as their capital. They're really saying, aren't they, Martin, that all the stuff that was achieved by the Israelis in the Six-Day War and in the October War in 1974, which triggered the massive oil shortage around the world, that all that is gone. And actually, what we need to do is get back to the original UN agreement with the Palestinians and Arabs in East Jerusalem and using that as their capital. This is quite, this for the Israelis and the Americans is like a red rag to a bull, and maybe for some British too. But one of the key countries in the area is Turkey. Turkey is sort of torn between Russia and NATO. And it was very interesting this week to see the Hagia Sophia Cathedral, a cathedral built many, many, many years, but in fact, I think it was 800 or 600 AD, one of the seven wonders of the world, changing from being a museum, which it's been for many years, rather than going back to becoming a cathedral, an Orthodox Christian place, a Muslim place instead. And I was scratching my head, is this a good thing or is this not a bad thing? But I thought I'd have a chat to someone that goes there fairly regularly, even though he's based in the United States. It's Vladimir Goldstein, and he's a lecturer in Slavic studies at one of the big American universities. So let's have a listen to his take now on this big change by Erdogan. What's he up to?
It was built in the 6th century by Constantinople Emperor Justinian, and he already at that time, he was very ambitious. So he knew what he was doing. So he invested, hired top-notch architect Isidore and Artemius, and asked them to build something which he, as he put it, would put Solomon in his temple to shame. So it was like a clear desire to put sort of all religion, Judaism, to shame, because we are now the new kids on the block, we're Christians, we're the greatest, we're the best. That's what he wanted to do. And he built this absolutely amazing structure, which was, was like a wonder, of the world at that time, 6th, 7th century. Just to give you a sense of how kind of, huge it was and how must have impressed people, first, like in terms of the size and number, and then a description of it. So in the year of 612, its staff consisted of 80 priests, 150 deacons, 40 deaconesses, 160 readers, 25 cantors or singers, and 100 doorkeepers. 100 doorkeepers. So it was a place where just, the whole Constantinople would go and pray and, among other things, admire and adore, because it was absolutely beautifully decorated. Here's this Byzantine historian Procopius in his book on buildings. He writes about Hagia Sophia, and that's what he writes. It's bath in sunlight and the reflection of sun rays. One might almost say that it is not illuminated from without by the sun, but from the radiance originated from within. Upon the central circle rises a sort of huge spherical dome, incomparable, beautiful structure. So it's sort of an impression, when you enter to pray, your mind is lifted up and as if you feel as if you walk in heaven.
Well, it sounds to me, not surprising, it was one of the wonders of the world. In those days, 6th century, this would have been extraordinary. People would have looked at that and say, well, how does that dome stay up there?
Absolutely. And it was, so I think it was a pride of this eastern part of Christianity. And then, of course, we have emerging of kind of sort of Russian lands. At that time in the 10th century, they have this Kievan Prince Vladimir, and the previous religion of Slavs, they were kind of pagans. They have their like old pagan pantheon, not dissimilar to the Scandinavians, not dissimilar to other ones. But for various reasons, historians will argue there was politics. I'm sure there was this and that. So Prince Vladimir decided to baptize Russia. You know, obviously there was a lot of political reasons, you know, like in today's world, alliances, marriages, money, whatever was involved.
But this was quite big, wasn't it? I mean, it was almost like Constantine in the Roman Empire. Absolutely. He suddenly decided to change things, didn't he? So this similar sort of thing happened in Russia too.
Yeah, absolutely. So, but what is important, according to sort of all these historical documents, like primary chronicles, the way Russians will tell their story of their conversion. So, of course, there might be like conversion has political, social, economic reasons, but also the myths, the stories which people tell. And the story, according to this chronicle, is very telling. So this Prince Vladimir cannot choose. He's, you know, Muslims try to impress him, Western Christians try to impress him, and Constantinople try to impress him. So first, which is fascinating, he rejects the Muslims, saying the drinking is the joy of Russia. We cannot live without this pleasure. So it's very so funny that already in the 12th century, that was one of the joys of Russia. Then, you know, he sends envoys to the Western lands, and they come back and say, we have reports from Hagia Sophia, and they were mesmerized. They were totally mesmerized, and they said, we've never seen such a beauty, the way they were describing it, for you know, we didn't know where we were in heaven or on earth when we were there. For on earth, there is no such splendor or such beauty, and we are at the loss of how to describe it. So this is kind of totally transformative experience. We only know that God dwells there among men, and their service is fairer than the ceremonies of other nations. We cannot forget this beauty. So it's very interesting, sort of A, conversion, but B, conversion in a particular way, conversion sort of by the beauty. And this kind of remains within Russian Orthodoxy, remains with Russian culture, which continues to respect kind of, you know, artistic expression, beautiful expression. And I think so Russians are very much vested in the whole kind of, you know, edifice. So, but what is interesting that for Orthodoxy, the beauty of the place is important. So just if we move to the present, as you said, turning into the mosque, you know, and we should respect all the religions and all their manifestations, but, you know, mosque does like the images. So basically, they will cover the beautiful, you know, kind of mosaics. So it wouldn't be the same kind of effect, at least of the visitors. When you preserve it as a museum, visitors can see it. Visitors can admire it. You know, they still would admire the structure from outside, say, but they wouldn't have this kind of sense of drenched in sunlight and so on. So
yeah, but can you see how some Christians, particularly Orthodox Christians, might say, well, actually, this, you know, this is not on, you know, this is usurping a Christian church, which was built by Christians for Christians and the Muslim faith. And I also understand that, for example, some of the frescoes, the Christian frescoes are going to be covered up now.
Yeah, I mean, it's very frustrating. Of course, you know, many people, you know, there are a lot of arguments, you know, to A, people understand that this is like Turkey. It's on their territory. It's kind of ultimately it's their decision. But, you know, we know that UNESCO recognizes tremendous amount of, you know, world heritage places. And what is surprising is that it's, you know, it found kind of some kind of, you know, middle ground. It was a museum. Of course, there were like minarets. Of course, there was a certain kind of, you know, on the, you know, probably quotations from Quran. But, you know, the rest of the stuff was preserved. And, you know, I've been there actually, last time I've been there was this October. And you can imagine people from all over the world. This is just a place to admire and, you know, to be moved and, you know, to contemplate. And I think it's probably that's how she should have stayed for some reason.
Do you think it's being used a bit of as a geopolitical pawn here? That the you know, it's a beautiful building, but maybe Erdogan is saying, well, you know, the West is waging this war on Islam, you know, in Afghanistan and various other places. Certainly in Iran, you know, they really don't like the Iranians. He's in a way sending a message out to the world that you know, Islam is very welcome in modern Turkey.
I think, you know, my feeling is that his, you know, basically politics, every politics is driven by economics. So I think it's primarily he's trying to decide internal issues. You know, there are certain economies not doing very well, like in most of the world. People might be disappointed in him. And so he tries to reinvent himself as some kind of a defender of Islam, as defender of this kind of great tradition. So, but he's driven, I suspect, by internal politics to begin with, but also by external, because he now feels that, for example, you know, whether for better or for worse, the main defender, say, of orthodoxy is Russia. Russia is not standing very well in the West. You know, there is always accusations of Russia by United States, by NATO countries, but United Kingdom. So he probably feels that weak spot, and, you know, maybe under different circumstances he could have maybe thought about it. But I guess when he put it all in the balance, winning some points domestically, winning some points within, you know, Islam world, and whatever he would lose, he also kind of probably have a feeling that he can buy off Russia, because he's still very much interested in trading in Russia. So he, on the balance, he thinks that he will win, but he is definitely is going to lose the hearts and minds of endless amount of Orthodox and probably other Christians. You know, I know the Catholics are very much kind of upset about it. So I think he might, in the long run, I think it's a very kind of myopic decision on his part.
So that's Vladimir Goldstein there. Martin, he's basically saying, it boils down to, this is just a kind of decision to try and bolster Erdogan's domestic support amongst Muslims, showing, I suppose, the idea really starting to turn around some of the secularization of the country by Ataturk.
Pretty much can't disagree with that. He's got elections coming up. His base are disappointed for various reasons, as a contributor pointed out. And he's been threatening to do this for years. And by doing it now, he's cashing that card in terms of trying to win elections inside Turkey. And of course, there's an ongoing struggle between the secularism of the state as originally conceived by Ataturk and the basically pro-Sunni Islam Muslim Brotherhood politics of Erdogan.
Okay, so let's move on and have a little look now, our penultimate item, at what we were doing last week, partially, which is the Phoenicians. And one of the people who was on the trip with Philip Beale across the Atlantic at the end of last year in this replica Phoenician vessel goes by the name of Lindsay McCauley, and he's an Australian. He's come up with a theory, actually, after having a holiday over in Mexico, and he has been proving it. And his book is just coming out very soon. We can talk about that when we've heard from him, about the way that he has discovered that the cubit, as a unit of measurement, it occurs in the building of the Mayan pyramids, as well as the building of the Egyptian pyramids and in Solomon's temple. So this is another very strong indication that those Phoenicians, 2000 BC, even that early, potentially, certainly by 1000 BC, were flitting backwards and forwards across the Atlantic like Philip was and Lindsay was last year. So let's hear a little bit from Lindsay McCauley about the amazing Mayan pyramid and the use of cubits.
A cubit's about the length from your elbow to your fingertips, and it was used as a measurement 3,000 years ago. There's a few varying lengths on the cubit, but one that came out to the front is the royal cubit, and that was used on Solomon's temple, and that was built by the Phoenicians. That's well documented, that the cubit was used on the Solomon's temple. That's the common link between ancient Israel, Egypt, and the temple of Kukulcan is the cubit. It's a very accurate representation of that measurement, and it's reflected in the calendar lengths used by the Mayans. So there's pretty strong evidence that something went on about probably 1,000 to 2,000 years ago that people actually came across the Atlantic. They met with the Mayans. It's a different history to the Spanish. When the Spanish came across, they conquered. The people that came across and worked with the Mayans 2,000 years ago actually collaborated, and they brought their knowledge and they integrated their knowledge. It was a collaborative thing that went on there, and they built this temple using each other's knowledge. the evidence is quite strong with that regard. And it throws a different light on that, on well, who discovered America or the history of America.
So that's Lindsay McCauley there. His book, Decoding the Lost World of the Maya, A Personal Odyssey by Lindsay McCauley, is just coming out in the next couple of weeks with an amazing picture of the prow of a Phoenician vessel with a great horse, which is the way that they used to embellish the boats that they built, the Phoenicians. Martin, you know, again, isn't it interesting that the same system of measurements was used on these Mayan pyramids? It does, again, it adds even more than what we were doing last week to evidence that there was some sort of cultural exchange going on across the Atlantic.
Well, I have to say, none of that is accepted in mainstream academia. That doesn't mean it's wrong. I'm just saying that that's the case. And if you think about it, the cubit, which is a measurement from your elbow to your fingers, that's a pretty natural thing for anybody to use if you're building stuff. Okay, you don't really need somebody to tell you to do it, do you?
Just explain, because what he's discovered is that, yes, you're right, of course, that this was a standard way of measuring things around the world, but a cubit would be different in one part of the world to another part of the world. What he's discovered is that these are exactly the same length as the cubits in the building of Solomon's Temple and of the Egyptian pyramids.
Well, when he mentioned Solomon's Temple, Solomon's Temple was destroyed. So whatever's left of it, if it ever existed, there's even disputes about whether it existed amongst archaeologists. It's buried somewhere under the Temple Mount. So saying that they used this, that, or the other doesn't mean anything, because nobody's ever seen Solomon's Temple.
Yeah, but
the
Egyptian pyramids exist, don't they?
Yes, they do. But the Mayan pyramids are quite different. And I've got no particular axe to grind here. He is trying to sell a book, and people like. they like discussing this kind of topic. I read an awful lot of archaeology books, and of course there is a mainstream view about this. At one stage, everybody thought that any new idea had to be a diffused idea. So somebody first of all thought about how to make iron weapons, and then everybody else copied them. But it's increasingly clear, I mean, the tendency now in modern archaeology is to see that most things that develop there's no reason why people in South America shouldn't have developed high-level civilizations without any outside input at all. They just have their own minds, which are the same as our minds. Homo sapiens' mental capacities haven't changed much in hundreds of thousands of years. And that means that, you know, your average Mayan is as brainy as your average modern, and therefore quite capable of inventing anything that they could invent. Of course, people do copy other people's ideas. But I come back to what we mentioned last week. When the Columbian Exchange took place, and I've just read a book about that, loads of people died because they were not they didn't have antibodies against diseases that had developed from mixing with farm animals in Eurasia. Now, if there had been earlier contacts, and thus earlier contacts have been in any way significant, you would have expected the Phoenicians to have taken over smallpox, influenza, etc. And that now it's possible that they did, and that there was a previous exchange of microorganisms. But it doesn't seem likely. And I think that the Vikings clearly did make short-lived settlement in Newfoundland. But they didn't have enough interaction with the locals to pass on the diseases. Now, that seems to me fairly conclusive.
Yeah.
If you don't pass on the diseases, then you haven't linked up with them.
Martin, those Viking ships were modelled on the Phoenician ships as well. Anyway, let's round off tonight by...
They were built in a completely different way, but it doesn't matter.
Let's round off... Well, a lot of people said that there's an enormous... Well,
they're both ships. They're both wooden ships, but Viking ships are clinker built. Phoenician ships were built on a frame. So it's a different, there's two different kinds of ships. Viking ships were unique.
So it's just, all I'm doing is I'm reporting what a lot of archaeologists have said, that there's a good deal of influence from Phoenician boats in the design of Viking ships.
Now, anyway, well, I don't accept that, but never mind. It's not worth arguing about.
Let's have a look at a bit more recent archaeology now, and the murder of PC Yvonne Fletcher in something you'll probably be more enamoured with, Martin. Actually, which is the 17th of April, 1984, when she was murdered in St James's Square in London, and murder was blamed on the Libyans. It's become pretty clear for anyone that bothers to look at this, particularly at this dispatches program, and that it was actually she was murdered by us, not by the Libyans. And it seems pretty horrific that you can get intelligence servicing murdering police officers, Martin. Why would they be able to get away with that?
Well, because they've done it before in the Gladio. The Gladio era in Italy, they murdered police officers. It's part of creating fear. And, you know, the political goal in this particular case was absolutely clear. The British had quite good relations with Gaddafi, and they were trying to do business with him in things like oil and so on. The American deep state weren't happy about that. Margaret Thatcher didn't seem to want to go down the road they wanted to go down, which was sanctions on Libya. So they arranged for a British, a 19-year-old British police officer to be killed so that Thatcher would then fall into line with sanctions on Libya, which she duly did. And, okay, of course, this has been in the news recently because they won't prosecute the guy they said did it because he didn't do it, as was discussed in those dispatches programs all those years ago.
So, 12 years after Yvonne Fletcher's death, there was this two-part dispatches, Murder in St James, which was broadcast in 1996, made by Fulcrum Films. And bizarrely, I was trying to contact on Twitter a couple of the people, the producer and the reporter involved, on the Twitter Messenger service. Went back to Twitter yesterday, Martin, and you won't believe it, those messages have just disappeared into thin air. How about that? Let's have a listen now to Steve Devereaux. He's a former SAS, operative, member of the SAS, soldier, see what he had to say about the operation where the SAS had been preparing for 10 days to storm the embassy.
The public expectation was that the SAS would storm the building and kill the occupants, just like the Iranian embassy siege 4 years earlier. One of the SAS soldiers called to the square was Steve Devereaux.
My main entry point was up here, the top right-hand window. You just about see it above the parapet. That was the first entry point. I would have run across the roof, placed the explosive charge on the particular window, blown the window, and then we would have assaulted through the window, four of us. Somebody throwing flashbangs, creating noise and havoc, taking out any targets that were in there. We would have had MP5s, two of us would have had shotguns, sawn-off shotguns, and pistols.
And you've expected that some of the Libyans would have had to be killed in this process?
If they were armed, yes.
Were you disappointed when you were stood there?
Absolutely right, yes. We'd psyched ourselves up for almost 10 days, 2 weeks. And to be told that, we weren't going to storm it, you know, that, it really wasn't. It pissed a lot of people off.
There's no doubt in your mind that you would have been able to successfully storm that embassy in the way that the Iranian embassy was stormed.
No problem. Absolutely no problem at all. And we would have done a bloody good job as well.
Instead, the diplomats were sent home. In public, Gaddafi gave them a hero's welcome. But in private, he was fighting for survival. 10 days after their return, he faced a major coup in which members of Al-Bakan took part. The French Secret Service and the CIA passed on satellite photographs and communications intercepts, but the rebellion failed after a street battle with the Libyan army. Ultimately, though, the killing of Yvonne Fletcher still served its purpose. 2 years later, American bombers flew from Britain to attack Libya. Other European states refused to let the bombers fly over their territory. Margaret Thatcher was also reluctant to get involved. But she was swayed by just two words, Yvonne Fletcher.
So that was a clip from the Dispatches documentary, Murder in St. James, from 1996, Martin. Now, look, I mean, amazing how such an incident as murdering a police officer the CIA, it seems, being involved in that, most definitely. I don't know if the British security services would have done it as well. Can be used as an excuse, basically, for a regime change.
Yeah, but I mean, people who are regular listeners to this show will know that what you see in the mainstream media is what you see in the mainstream media. And the reality of what goes on behind the scenes is what it is. And that the murder of, you know, it's quite cynical, really. They chose her because she was young, photogenic, and it would definitely get the desired effect. And of course, the Libyans inside the embassy were armed. They opened fire on people on the other side of the road who were protesting against them, shooting over their heads. And when they knew the Libyans were going to do that because they got bugs inside the embassy. And while the Libyans were doing their fighting, shooting over their heads, a completely different bullet was used. It was the same caliber as the bullet as the Libyans were using, but it came from a completely different direction. And it was, and the second part of the dispatches program showed how they brought the weapon in from Germany, which had been bought on the black market. Now, this is the way the world works, folks. 9/11 attack wasn't carried out by people in Afghanistan. WCC Fletcher wasn't killed by the Libyans. The Lockerbie bombing wasn't carried out by the Libyans. There's all sorts of stuff like this, and it's easy to get lost in it all. But obviously what really matters in the end is the facts. That's what matters.
And that's what we're digging out here. I mean, what it does do, from imagine the situation in 1984, you've got all these SAS preparing to storm the embassy. Somebody somewhere says, look, we've done this with the Iranians already. It might not look good. Let's kill a police officer instead. Maybe that's the way to do it.
Well, no, I think they planned to kill a police officer in the first place. The talk of storming the embassy was just talk. And, of course, when they stormed the Iranian embassy, the people that went into the Iranian embassy was what is now called MEK. MEK are Islamist Marxist terrorists who are opposed to the Iranian government. So they were the ones, and of course, they're now our allies. In those days, they shouldn't have, you know, they treated them as enemies of Britain because they did what they did on British soil. But of course, we were quite hostile to the Iranian regime, and we were quite friendly to MEK, as we still are. And of course, they carry out all sorts of attacks inside Iran all the time. That's why that's your taxes at work, folks.
What about the situation in Libya now, Martin? It's all rather falling apart. You've got Khalifa Haftar and an official government, apparently, as well.
Well, it's a terrible mess.
So two governments, effectively, with a whole load of people.
Well, yes, there's two ostensible governments, and there's also loads of just lawless people. You know, it's basically broken. It's become very similar to Iraq, and of course, it's a very very dangerous. It's closer than Iraq. We've had all of these refugees pouring out of Libya since we liberated it. And, of course, there was no real evidence that Gaddafi was going to use aircraft on demonstrators. That was rubbish. But on the back of that, the resolution that was passed in the UN Security Council, the Russians and the Chinese, and they now regret this, they abstained on the no-fly zone over Libya. Because what they presumed was that the West would put in a no-fly zone to prevent Gaddafi using aircraft, but then that would lead to a political solution. But of course, they were double-crossed by the West. The West basically used the RAF. They killed thousands of people, and just like we're doing in Yemen. And of course, Gaddafi was overthrown, had a bayonet stuck up his bum by the insurgents and a bullet through the head. And that was job done. But, of course, it wasn't job done for Libya, because Libya, which used to have the highest standard of living in Africa, is now a basket case. Black Libyans and black Africans have been ethnically cleansed and killed. And there's now a face-off going on between the one lot of countries, Egypt and Saudi Arabia. France is on that side as well. Are backing Haftar, and of course Turkey are backing the other lot, and there's a potential for a war in Libya between the Egyptians and the Turks, and of course there could be a war between Turkey and Greece, or the potential for fighting all over the world is probably as high as it's ever been, and we're only not recognizing that because of A, the COVID crisis, and B, the economic crisis that's on the back of the COVID crisis.
Well, I mean, it does
in many ways, we're in a geopolitical crisis.
Yeah, I mean,
it's an inflection point.
It does seem to me as if, you know, you've got this failed attack on Syria, which was an attempt at regime change there. That's failed. And that the COVID and the exaggeration of the COVID is a kind of manifestation of the deep state's frustration with not being able to achieve what it wanted to in Syria. So turning its guns on its domestic population, trying to subdue them instead.
Well, it may be, as I say, the COVID could be a natural phenomenon or it could be a deliberate attack. But either way, what it's doing is bringing everything to a head. We're going to have to face up to all of these problems simultaneously. So we're going to have both medical, military and economic problems all wrapped up in one big improvised explosive device. And okay. goodness knows what's going to come out of that.
Back to Yvonne Fletcher and the Foreign Secretary and the Defence Secretary would be two key ministers who would have almost certainly have been in the loop if something like that was to have happened.
Well, you can't presume that.
Well, no, I'm saying almost certainly. I'm not presuming it. I'm saying almost certainly in the loop. The reason for that is because if it was discovered that something had happened that they hadn't been previously signed off, then they could potentially go ballistic. And so you can't do that. But anyway, one of them, the Foreign Secretary, was Sir Geoffrey Howe. He's dead now. He died in 2015. But the Defence Secretary at the time, who is likely, I would attest, to have given the nod to something like the murder of Yvonne Fletcher, is Michael Heseltine. He was Defence Secretary.
Yeah, but the way I see these things working is that what happens is that they don't ask the questions about things that they don't need to know about, and therefore they don't know about. They need plausible deniability. You don't run everything past the political leadership. And if you remember what happened when Dave Shaler and Annie Machon went to Robin Cook, because he was the Foreign Secretary at the time, and said, look, MI6 are engaged in trying to assassinate Gaddafi, the MI6 certainly hadn't told Robin Cook what they were doing. And generally, they won't unless they want to. The deep state is just that. It's deep. That's the whole point about it. And in fact, probably many of the people who are the most powerful in it, nobody even knows who they are. And the politicians are basically very low level. They're only included when it's necessary. And well, basically, they're only told what they need to know.
See if we can get an interview with Michael Heseltine and put that to him. It'd be very interesting to see what his reply was. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, that is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. You can download our MP3s and listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, comment page and our contact details at thisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Tune in on Sunday evenings at 6 on BCFM 93.2 with Danny Loch. And BCFM's boss, Pat Hart, did say that our sister show, Dialect, would be on BCFM Monday at 10. So far, it hasn't been at all. We hope it to be on a new FM channel soon. Do please join us for the Politics Show live stream, 5 o'clock every Friday. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down. We'll